Okay, other than that, I give you Russell.
Hi, everybody. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group, and I haven't found out I should have a drink since January 17th, 1981, and it's good to be here. And if you're keeping count, this is supposedly, step eight, but don't get your hopes up. Just for those who are new to the steps, it's made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. But I have some things I want to talk about, and I sort of think they have something to do with step eight and step three and all sorts. They have to do with all sorts of stuff. It really depends upon what step you're on. I really do believe, I just know this is true after, experience. You just gain a lot through experience. I mean, anybody in here who's ever been in a job for a long period of time, I'm a lawyer, so I graduated law school like 35, 40 years ago, whatever the heck I graduated, and I knew more about the law after taking the bar exam and cramming the day after I graduated law school than I'll probably ever know in my entire life. I mean, all aspects of jurisprudence. And I knew so much about the law, I knew just enough to get you in trouble if you were my client. But after 35 years of practice, I started to know the judges, and I did a lot better. What I guess I'm saying is when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with the experience. So when you go in for your operation by your neurosurgeon, you don't want to find out he was the most brilliant kid in school and this is his first operation. You want to go with the dummy who's done 1,000 of them, you know what I mean? And he can do it in his sleep. So there is something to be said, if you're in this deal that we're doing here, that no matter how much you think it's your brain, it's your intelligence. I have guys, they do things like this. I mean, if you stick around, you'll get stuff like this. You'll get a guy who's helpless, hopeless, is crazy, is coming back for the 10,000th time, and he'll say, "Will you sponsor me?" And you'll say, "Yes," and then he'll tell you what he thinks he needs you to do. Man. He'll self-diagnose and tell you what he wants you to do. And you'll try to explain something to him, and you'll say, "No, he'll tell you he doesn't think that's the problem." You want to say it's really impossible to sponsor somebody like that. It really is. It's impossible. Don't even try because they're not ready. They need to drink some more because they're just way too smart for you because they haven't figured out the powerlessness yet. And there is something to be said for learning for on-the-job experience. I'd say most of the stuff, I read the big book like everybody else, and I've read it backwards and forwards. I continue to read it, and I quote it. Probably quoted here today. A lot of stuff I say is just paraphrased from the big book. But there is something to be learned and something to be said for living life and dealing with bounce checks, relatives, friends, problems, cancer, all the crap you deal with on a day basis for 30 years while trying to work this thing and not drink. There's something to be said from getting through the day, every day, working these things on the job training to see, because it's only by working them and staying sober and trying to figure out how not to hate that son of a bitch and get him out of your brain, and how to be a good, decent person and stay out of trouble and also not drink and be emotionally sober and trying to apply all these things. There's something about doing it on the job that really is a real learning experience. And, in our big book, they talk about that guy, Roland Hazard. Remember him? And that's a typical alcoholic. It says in the 12 and 12, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his devastating weaknesses and all their consequences, sobriety will be precarious and of true happiness will find none at all. And one of the things that I've seen with all alcoholics, and it probably has something to do with defiance, is we all believe that we're really smart. Certainly smarter than anybody else when it comes to us. And so we're all defiant. We don't like people telling us what to do, right? You know something? Unless you get over the "I don't like people telling me what to do" thing, you're never going to get sober. Unless you get over the "I don't like the way he's talking to me" thing, you are not going to get sober. Unless you somehow, alcoholics don't like to hear it. There are people that are going to listen to this either on the tape or here who are going to hear this and say that's bullshit because they just don't want to accept it. It's like the thing they say in a sign in my office, the truth, you can't handle the truth. They don't want to believe. They'll do anything. They want to stay sober, but just don't tell me I've got to sort of like submit myself to another human being. Where does it say that in the big book? Well, it talks all about humility. And you can talk about humility all you want, but until you look at another human being saying, tell me what to do, what should I do, and not argue, and not give them the you don't understand or the yes butters or something like that. Everybody I know who is 20, 30, 40 years sober to good purpose, if they start talking long enough, they're going to start talking about their sponsor or the men in their lives or the older men that they followed and they listen to. So somehow you got to get to that point where you're submitting yourself to somebody else and following directions. You know, because, you know, I'm a firm believer in God, and we're going to talk about that. But, you know, God speaks through people. And unless you're willing to listen to him and listen to some people and submit yourself to that deal, you know, it ain't going to work out. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and because the eighth step sort of deals with people and sort of deals with our problems with people. And one of my devastating weaknesses is I think I'm, like, real smart. And I think I can solve this thing in my own brain. You know, I'll just go to one of Russell's step series, and I don't need a sponsor, and I'll read the book, and I'll solve this thing. And, you know, Roland Hazard said, after submitting himself to Carl Jung, one of those brilliant psychiatrists, you know, it's right in our big book, he says, now knowing the inner workings of his mind, he was convinced that drinking was impossible. And the next line is, nevertheless, within a few weeks, he was drunk. That's when he goes up to Dr. Jung and he says, is there no hope? And Dr. Jung goes, that those that hear there, there's a psychic change, you know, stuff that you really can't manufacture. It's like not in your hands, it's in God's hands. And isn't that what the book says? The A, B's, and C's that we have to be convinced of, that we cannot manage our own lives. No human power could relieve their alcoholism. Only God could and would if he were sought. You know, my sponsor, you know, one of the fun things I have with this is I really don't plan this stuff, sort of, in conventional sort of planning, writing it out. But I have certain thoughts that I want to get across to you that I'm thinking of. And I sort of had fun with this thing. You really need to have fun with this stuff. It really helps to be sober. I mean, physically and mentally sober to do this kind of stuff. And one of the fun things I like to do is I start thinking about the eighth step and what it means to me and what it means to me in my life now at 30 years. And one of the funnest things I have in Alcoholics Anonymous is telling you what's on my mind and what's on my heart and trying to figure out how to wrap it all up to the eighth step. And so I know there are people in here that don't think I'm going to get there. So I just love surprising you. You may think this has everything to do with the eighth step, what I'm talking about. I have a sponsor, and his name's John Glenn. I've had three sponsors. You know, they've never been able to find a permanent one. They all, like, get old and die on me. But they're wonderful men. And, you know, one of the things he does, he's a Baptist preacher. And so when we sit down to eat, he prays. And so he started me he's been my sponsor, I guess, for 12, 13 years. So now whenever I eat in a restaurant or whatever, or with a group of guys who did tonight, we pray before we eat in a restaurant. And that's and anybody who knows me who's part of the Lost Sheep or who was on the distribution list, every day I usually eat with between 6 and 12 or 20 guys, and we have big meetings like that. And we're men, and we all eat in different restaurants, and we all pray beforehand. Many times John is there. And, you know, I'm like most alcoholics. I was, whether I believe in God or not, you know, I mean, God's great, but I mean, like, in public. Yeah. You know, when they told me to do the third step, when I finally got the time when I had to do the third step and I read the thing and it says we get down on our knees and we say this deal and all that sort of stuff, I went into my house and I went into the bathroom of my house and nobody was in my house and the doors were locked. I went to the bathroom of my house and I locked the door. And I got on my knees. That's why I did the third step prayer, because I didn't want to take the chance that somebody might actually wander into my locked house and then wander into the bathroom and see me. I mean, what's that deal? You know what I mean? If that ain't fear of people. And one of the devastating weaknesses of alcoholics is incredible fear of people. It says in the promises, fear of people. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave you. And if you're an alcoholic like me, who is a bar drinker, so I was always drinking in a bar with gazillions of people and hanging around with people and cutting up with people, the last thing you're ever going to believe is that you're scared of people. As a matter of fact, you love people. But you sort of look back and you say, if you love people so much, how come you're always drunk when you were with them? How come you had to lubricate yourself in order to have sex or talk to a girl or to dance or do anything? How come whenever you went in the bar, you'd see that group and you'd worry about, will they accept me? I was great with people as long as I was drunk. How come if I'm in a cocktail party now, or if I'm going to somewhere now where there's drinking or something going on, I feel maybe uncomfortable around people? If I was not scared of people, or worried about judgment and stuff like that. You start, you know, I mean, what, you know, why would they say fear of people will leave you unless we're incredibly scared of people? And one of the things we're in denial of is how petrified we are of other people, and we don't even know it. How does that affect our lives? How does that affect our relationships? How does it affect everything? Because I don't know whether you've noticed, they're pretty much as common as dirt. They're all over the place. Nothing but people. And you're always dealing with them. You know what I mean? And so one of the things my sponsor said when he first got me the praying in public thing is he would say things like cute things like this. You know, I don't know how many people know my sponsor, John Glenn. He comes up here every once in a while. He says, Russ, we have to pray. He said, and then I'd pray, and he'd say, he says, now the food will taste better because it has the secret ingredient. Like I'm a 10-year-old, you know what I mean? I have six grandchildren. I would talk to my 6-year-old like this. He'd say, you know, but if you're an alcoholic, you're sort of like 6 years old. You know, he would say, now, Russ, he says, it has the secret ingredient, you know what I mean? And you know what happens when you submit yourself to a sponsor? It doesn't matter. You know, I got a law degree. I have all these postgraduate degrees and all sort of stuff. And I don't think he's ever graduated high school. It doesn't matter. When you follow a man like that, a man of God, a humble man, when you follow somebody like that, they warp you. You get warped. I don't know what it is. You know, I was sitting next to somebody in a plane, and I was talking about AA, or they found out I was an AA. He says, that's like a cult. And, I didn't argue with him. He says, but it's a good cult. You know what I mean? So you get warped in AA. You know, you get warped in AA, but it's like a good warping. I remember once saying to my sponsor, I signed with this about, you're brainwashing me. And he says, well, maybe your brain needs washing. You know what I mean? So you get in here, and you think one way, and a year later, you're thinking completely different. You're sort of thinking the way your sponsor, you come in here thinking your sponsor's crazy, and a year later, you're talking like him. You know what I mean? But you feel better, and you're not drinking. So you start realizing you've been brainwashed, but it's sort of like a good thing. So, you know, he's got me actually believing that there is like a secret ingredient when you pray. You know what I mean? It's a secret ingredient. There's a secret ingredient when you believe in God and you're doing the steps. You know, that ingredient may be lacking if your faith is lacking, even if you're going through the motions of doing the steps. There may be people that are doing this program and are going to ultimately drink no matter how many steps they do, because that secret ingredient may be lacking. You know, it says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. He says, job or no job, let no man say he has to have his wife back. You know what I mean? Nonsense. It's the only requirement is to trust in God and clean house. It's all about your relationship with God. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. What does it matter if you do all these steps if there's no belief? Maybe the secret ingredient is important even in the eighth step. So, listen, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Things weren't going so good for me. I don't know about you. Most people don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous like riding the crest, you know, after they win the $1 million. And, you know, it wasn't riding the crest. Things were bad. I still had a job, but believe me, I was unemployable, okay? I was in bad shape. I was a trial attorney, but if I was talking to you, I'd get through mid-sentence and I forget what I was going to say, which really isn't good if you're a trial attorney. So I came in unemployable, and I picked up a white chip, and 3 months later, after going to a lot of meetings and hanging around my sponsor, I got rocketed to the level of underpaid. It's pretty good. You go from the level of losing everything, your self-esteem, everything. You know you're 31 years old and your life is over. And in 3 months, you're underpaid and they don't appreciate you. And they're screwing with you. You know what I mean? So I went up to my sponsor and I explained to him, you know, how I was being mistreated. And I joined the ranks, you know, the other fellowship they have in here. There's the Fellowship of the Spirit. And to be a member of the Fellowship of the Spirit is more than just... Remember, to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you just have to have the desire to stop drinking. It doesn't even have to be an honest desire. That's too high. Just a desire. That gets you in. But there's a little bit of a different qualification to be a member of the Fellowship of the Spirit. That's a whole different thing they talk about, that deal. But I became a member of that other group in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a charter member of the Fellowship of the Thumb-Sucking Crybabies. That's the group when you go to meetings, and after the meeting, you need a meeting because they've all been talking. You know, this one says, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. My wife, my daughter, my husband, my children, whatever it is, and they go on with this long Queen for a Day story. How many people are old enough to remember Queen for a Day? the queen for the day, the self-pity, the whole story. And then the next person tries to top them. You think that's something, you know what I mean? You might as well be in a bar, you know, you think that's something. And you just pray that there's some old-timer there, you know, that sets them straight. But, you know, most people in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's another disease we have, doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and we don't want to be political correct, and love and tolerance is our code, and God forbid you should say something to make them think, or, you know, or get her, hurt their feelings, you know, so... So after the meeting, you feel worse than before the meeting started. Because nobody's talking to the solution. They're all talking about the problem. You know, so I went up to my sponsor and I explained to him about how my boss was mistreating him and mistreating me and all sorts of horrible things were happening to me and it was unfair and life was unfair. And he looked at me, all 15 years sober of him, and he said, you know, I think it's time you started making coffee for the group. And this had nothing to do with the problem, you know? I mean, but unfortunately, when you're new and you only have 3 months and you're scared of drinking and everything, they catch you with like in a vulnerable position. You know what I mean? You're like vulnerable. You know, you don't want to drink. You're scared to drink. You haven't had a drink in 3 months. You know it has something to do with this guy. You're trying to tell him that you're broke, your boss doesn't like you, your life is falling apart, you need this, that, and the other thing. And all of a sudden, he starts talking to you about coffee. And you realize it's because he's brain dead, that he doesn't understand or anything like that, and he starts showing you how to make the coffee. And let me tell you something. It didn't escape my notice that he had been the one making the coffee with that group up to that time. That I was like taking over his position. So I didn't say it, but I knew. I said, this is how they get out of doing the work. They get some, this is like some sort of Tom Sawyer thing. They get some new guy who's vulnerable and they get him to do this stuff. And so but what am I going to do? He's my sponsor. So I start making the coffee, you know what I mean? And I started making the coffee. I was a pretty good coffee maker for that group, as a matter of fact. And I became really into making that coffee. As a matter of fact, like a week later, some other guy tried to take over making the coffee. He said, hey, that's my job. I'm the coffee maker around here. And 9 months later, I was trying to get rid of the job. I was doing it for 9 months. I said, I announced to the meeting. I said, I can make the coffee next week. I'm going to have to quit the coffee job. Who will take over? And like nobody raised their hands. And I did it for another 9 months. I finally said to my sponsor, I said, nobody's volunteering to make the coffee. He says, look, Russell, these are alcoholics. Don't ask for people to volunteer. Just next week, don't make the coffee. Somebody will step up to the plate. And I did it, and that's how it happened, you know? So, but, you know, there's something interesting that happened. When I started making that coffee, even though my sponsor is an idiot and he didn't understand what I was talking about, and I started focusing on making that coffee and getting involved in that group and doing the coffee, all of a sudden, for a short period of time, I stopped whining about my problem. I stopped whining about my problem. You know, it's an interesting thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been drinking ever since I was 15 years old, one way or another, until I was 31. Drinking and hanging out with guys and getting drunk. And I swear to God, and I'm not saying I have that good of a memory, I don't remember ever, in a bar or ever anywhere, talking about or thinking about God. I don't remember even that being the subject. As a matter of fact, well, why would it be the subject? It had nothing to do with anything I was interested in. It wasn't relative to anything, related to anything I was interested in. I was interested in women, cars, and money. And anything that revolved around those areas, like American Express cars, Playboy bunnies, you know, I mean, prestige or anything. And God has nothing to do with those things. As a matter of fact, it was my opinion that God is like blocks that crap. I think he's anti-woman, he's anti, I think he's against that. He may not be, but I thought that. I think he's anti-everything. I think God he throws the cold water on the whole thing. I'm against no God, because I want to go for that stuff. You know, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, all of a sudden, and this is the deal. I never spoke about God, never hung out with people that talked about God. All the people I hung around talked about the stuff I wanted to talk about, the crap I talked about, which was the stuff I'm talking about. And all of a sudden, I find myself on a hospital gurney at 31 years of age, and I thought my life was over and it was never going to be better again. And I look up and I say, God help me. God help me. I mean, where did that come from? You know, it says in the big book, sometimes your experiences in life have to beat you down enough so that you can find yourself within the big book and say, there I am. And all of a sudden I'm reading this big book and it says we find that God is deep down inside of every human being. But he's usually covered up by so much horse shit. So much of that other crap that we don't even know he's there. You know, but it's only when you get that incomprehensible demoralization and there's nothing. There's no woman, there's no car, there's no money, there's no job. It's all stripped away and it's just you in the mirror and who are you kidding? All of a sudden, God appears when you want him enough. Isn't that what Bill says? And that was my experience. But in order for it to be my experience and for me to understand that that is the truth, I had to go through the experience. So going through the pain and having it ripped away and coming in here not on the crest but on your knees is part of the deal. It's part of what has to happen in order for you to see that this stuff is true and this stuff is right and it's real. And it's not fluffy at all. This God thing, even though you think it's not fluffy at all. I mean, there's concrete underneath those lily pads. This is the real deal. You can base your life. You can anchor your life on this stuff. It's the cars. Excuse me, women. It's not you. It's the cars. It's the romance. Whether you're a woman, it's the romance. It's that other stuff that's fluffy that you can't anchor things on. That you can't trust, that goes away. The stuff that we think is going to fix us, that is never going to fix us. There's no man, there's no woman, there's no person, there's no amount of money, there's no job that you can anchor it to, and it'll stay and it'll keep you happy all the time. And you want something, if you ever find that and you anchor yourself to, you're destined to a fall because you're going to be able, I remember the guy who said, he owned a restaurant. He says, how you doing? He says, great. The restaurant's doing great. We're making all sorts of money. I said, well, that's fantastic. I hope you always do great. A week later, he was drunk. Restaurant didn't do that good that week. You know? So you come in here, and all of a sudden, I come to AA, and I call out to God. I don't know where that came from. And then I come to AA, my sponsor gives me this little black book, 24-hour book. He says, I want you to ask God's help every day to stop drinking. And I did that for 15, 20 years. Every day in the morning, I still do it. God, help me not to drink today. And the little black book, you know, if you know it has a, you know, the 24-hour book, this is before we got politically correct. It's a mixture of the Bible, the big book, you know what I mean? It has prayer for the day, meditation for the day, and then there's prayer, and I read that every day. And I would hang out with guys that would talk about God, and I would listen to people that were talking about God. As time went on, you know, when you hang out with people that talk about God, and those are the things you're talking about, and you fellowship with those people, and you read about that stuff, and you bring them into your life, you want to know something, that relationship becomes realer and realer and realer. It becomes part of your life. And you know what I realized? That as that became more and more part of my life, this stuff became, the principles and everything in this book became easier to take and to see and to use, and my life just got better. In all respects, got better. You know, I think maybe it was, you know, I want to say it was the steps because I did the steps. I want to say it was because of the sponsor. But the truth of the matter is, although I was doing all that at the time, my attitude and everything about me got better the more I got closer to him. See to it that your relationship with him is right. God could and would if he was so. Well, why not? He's the power. We had to find the power. Granted ourselves, lack of power, that was our dilemma. The closer I got to him. And now my relationship with him is more solid than it's not. You know, I started 15 years, I started going to a Bible study, hanging around with men. Let me tell you something, AA is powerful. I love AA, I go to a lot of AA meetings. AA, the big book, encourages church membership. It encourages membership in congregations. You know, and I've never met a church where it isn't God as you understand them. Even in my church, and I'm a Christian, you know, where they believe in Jesus, they talk about Jesus, it's all Jesus as you understand them. Everybody has an individual relationship with their own God. But there's something powerful about being in a group of 40 men who are all on the same page on the God deal, and there's no fool there saying, well, I don't believe in that stuff. You know what I mean? There's something powerful about not worrying about pissing somebody else off because you love God and you want to talk. There's a powerful thing there. And so now, and I don't know, it's a design for living that works, like the big book says. And every once in a while, like all of you in here, everybody ever have a day or something like that, but maybe you've just had a full day, maybe it's a good day, maybe it's a worrisome day, or whatever it is, where it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and your head hits the pillow and you just can't go to sleep. You ever have that deal? You just can't go to sleep. You might even be overly tired, but you just can't go to sleep. And you know what? I think about the God of my understanding. I just think about it. You know, when that happens, I think about him. I think about God. I think about talking to him and being with him. I think about him and who he is and what he is and everything like that. And next thing I know, I'm waking up and it's the morning. It's the morning. You know, he's even better than a sleeping pill. You know, he works for me. That deal works for me. And so when I was about 10 years old, and I might have told this story before in here. If I did, forgive me, but it illustrates the deal. It's a true story. It says our stories disclose. I lived in Saddle Rock, New York. Very nice place. And, you know, we had kids, and we you know, after school, we would choose up sides and play baseball or football or something like that, and we'd have two captains. And, you know, they're usually the guys who are the good players. And I was always horrible at sports. Drunk, sober, it doesn't matter. I was horrible at sports. And, you know, they'd have about 10 or 12 guys in the middle of the field, little kids. And those days, you know, back in the day, but they don't care how smart you are or anything. It's all about how are you, you know, at pitching and catching and stuff like that. And so the bottom line is they'd be had two captains, and you'd be in the middle of the field and one'd say, well, I'll take George. And then George would go over to one captain. He said, anybody ever been involved in this deal? He said, I'll take Steve. And Steve would go with the other captain. And you're like there in the middle. And I still remember it like it was yesterday. The fear of humiliation. I remember the prayers I used to pray. And I didn't believe in God. I'd say, God, please don't let me be last. I didn't pray to be first. I just didn't want to be the one they hated the most. You know what I mean? That was left out there in the middle of the field. And as they're picking these guys, it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And then there's just me and one other guy left. And it seems to me like I was always picked last. I mean, I was picked second to last, if there was some guy there they hated more than me, it was like being picked first. You know what I mean? It was like the greatest feeling in the world. But it seems to me I was always picked last. And you know how they pick you? They do one of these numbers. Oh, do we have to get them? You know, it's like they'd rather play with one less than with me on the team. And what would happen with me when that would happen, I'm just going to tell you what would happen with me, is a very strange thing. And I never thought about it until I was many years sober. You know, isn't that funny the way your mind works? I'm sure I never thought. You see, I think a lot of this stuff that we think about when we're sober after 10, 15, 20 years, they come to mind and we think about things. It doesn't come from the planet Venus. All this pathological, crazy, traumatizing, horrible stuff that happened when we were kids, embarrassing, humiliating stuff. It doesn't all of a sudden we get sober 20 years and all of a sudden it's shipped in from Saturn. It's always been there, affecting me and how I look at you, affecting me and how I look at myself, affecting me and how I act towards other people. I just never knew it. It was buried so deep. But all of a sudden, 20 years sober, you're working the steps and you remember all this crap. You know, it's better than hypnosis. You know what I mean? You just remember this stuff. And all of a sudden, I started remembering this thing. And I remembered that one of the things I used to do, and you don't even know, here's the things. Most of the stuff I did that was harmful to me and harmed me, I didn't even know I was doing at the time I was doing it. Only looking back on it, I see it. You know how it says in the book? It says, our alcoholic life seems the only normal. Our crazy, warped thinking seems so normal because we do it so much that we don't even realize what we're doing. It's just something we do. It's just, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys, and I talk to a lot of people, and I'm happy to give people help. And I wish I had a tape recording that I could play you of how many people will ask me a question. And I'll listen to their question because I'm interested in what they have to say. And, you know, I've been sober 30 years. I'm not saying I'm God or I'm that smart, but I mean, you know, I've been sober for a while and they're obviously asking me. So I always assume when an alcoholic asks me, they're actually interested. Of course, that's a weird assumption. Don't necessarily make that exception. You know, some people want help and some people just want attention. And so somebody will ask me a question and I'll give them the answer. And before the last word is out of my mouth, they say, no, that's not it. In other words, they don't even give me the respect of waiting 30 seconds to think about what I said. That it might be right. They've already rejected it. It's on the next thing. I can't possibly be right. They're not even thinking about that maybe I'm giving them a gem, a key to their entire life, and they don't want to hear it. And you know why they don't want to hear it? Because they can't hear it. Because if I'm right, then they have to change, and they ain't going in that area. They ain't going to this because this is the way they've always thought. I've always felt this way. I've always thought this way. I've always been this way. And I'm not going to change. And if I accept what he says, then I got to come to his restaurant instead of being in my house. I did that for Richard. He'll know what I mean. I have to change, and I don't want to change because this is my comfort zone. Isolating from people, staying away from people, staying with myself, not changing, not reaching out. You know, I might have to go to his meeting or go where he is rather than go where I want to go. And so what would happen, one of the things I realized I used to do in that group when that happened to me is I wanted to cry. Has anybody ever been humiliated or stuff like that? I wanted to cry. I was humiliated. But instead what I would do is I would do something very strange. Somehow in my mind it would tell me that if I cried or I yelled, I showed they hurt me, it would really be something horrible would happen. You know, with alcoholics, there's always something horrible that's going to happen. I would die. Something would happen. So the only way I could protect myself was almost like protection, self-protection. Is that if I acted like it didn't bother me, like I laughed about it, like I, almost like I wasn't in me, I was really with them, I was really on their side. Like there were two me's. There was the me that was being pounded and humiliated, and there was another me, and I was actually staying with them, I was the me who was picked first. And if I sort of laughed like, oh yeah, like it didn't bother me, then they'd forget about it and it would be okay and everything would be okay. So, and that came naturally. I would act differently than the way I felt. So the way to protect myself is to never let anybody see how I really feel and to act like things don't hurt me. And how was I to know that that sort of thing I did at 10 years old was by the time I was 24, built up a wall between me and you that was three feet thick that were going to make me feel like a moral leper. So I would never let anybody get close to me because the bottom line is deep down inside, whether I knew it or not, I was always worried about being hurt. And I was always worried about being judged. And it was all about what do they think about me and why did I say that and what am I going to say and second-guessing myself 18 ways from Sunday and wondering what they think about me and worrying about relationships and being overly sensitive. How did I even know that I was so scared of people that I could never have a relationship with anybody? And all of a sudden I get to this eighth step and the ninth step and all these steps and it says this, step 8 and 9 are concerned with personal relations. Personal relations, that's the first sentence, but I like the last sentence the best. Whenever our pencil falters, we can fortify and cheer ourselves by remembering that AA experience in this step has meant to, what it's meant to others. It is the beginning, now listen to this, it is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. Not even from other people. Isolation from God. Now, I got to tell you something. Isolation from our fellows is pretty bad. Isolation from God is pretty... You know, if you're isolated from our fellows and you're isolated from God, that means all you got is you. You ever hear what the novelist says most people live lives of quiet desperation? You've heard that. So, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you know, see, one thing I've learned about alcohol, one of the great things you learn when you've been an Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, you start learning about yourself and how you feel and what's going on in yourself, is I'll tell you a little secret of what happens to you after 30 years. You learn, you know about everybody else. Did you know that? You see, you didn't know that. This is what the deal is. What you realize, you have to be in AA for 30 years and listen to people, listen to what they say and sponsoring people, is you realize we're all like twins. We may act differently and speak differently, but you realize we're all like twins. The only difference is the problem is we're all like twins. We're all exactly the same. Maybe a little bit more here, a little bit more there, but we're in different levels of awareness. And so I'll find myself talking to a man, and I see exactly what's going on inside him, like an X-ray, and he doesn't have any clue as to what I'm talking about. And he's trying to tell me I don't understand, and you don't know, and you don't understand. Say, you don't understand. You're me 10 years ago. I know exactly what you're thinking and why you're thinking. And if I told you what you were thinking and why you were thinking, you wouldn't even understand me, and you'd say I was wrong. And if you manage to stay sober, 10 years from now, you're going to be seeing everything I'm saying. But you're not going to see anything I'm saying now because you're not ready to see it, and you don't want to see it. You want to know something? You want to fight me over it and get mad over it. You want to get upset over it. You know, that's the great thing about, and you want to know something? When you realize that everybody's a twin, you don't ever have to be scared of talking anymore in groups. You don't have to worry about what people think about you. Because you're just talking to yourself. Anyway. You know, it don't even matter. It's the same old deal, you know. You're just talking to yourself. And so, here's what I know about alcoholics. Besides the fact that you're scared of people. I know everybody in here is scared stiff of people. And it really doesn't matter if you say, no, I'm wrong, because that only proves to me that the book is right when they say they usually don't think so. It just proves to me that you're in denial, because I accept what they say in the book. I believe the book is true. It's kept people sober for years. I believe it's true. So I believe there's not a person in here that isn't scared of people and the judgment of people. And if you're scared of people, that means you build walls with people. That means you can't have a relationship with people, because how can you have a relationship with somebody when you're worried about whether or not they're going to punch you? When all you're doing is worrying about what you're going to say and what you're going to do and what you're going to look like, how can you have a relationship with them when you don't trust them and you think they're going to trust you, punch you? And even on your best day, you're sort of wary of them. Unless, of course, you're drunk, which is what we all look for, getting drunk, because when you're drunk, at least you have a shot of having some sort of drunken relationship with someone. Because we're so hungry, we crave so much personal contact in a relationship. We crave it so much. That's why we love to drink, because it's the only time we can get spiritually and physically laid and feel like we're close to somebody, because the rest of the time we feel like we're out there orbiting Venus. Crazy thing is, if you're an alcoholic, you can be in a group with 3,000 people and you feel like you're alone and nobody understands you. You know? And there's nobody in here that doesn't understand what I'm talking about, because you're all like that deal. The loneliness, the emptiness. That's why we get back to meetings. It's that weird sort of thing. We go to that meeting, we feel good for 5 minutes, and it's that 5 or 10 minute after effect, and then we get in the car and we drive away and we're alone again. Alone with our thoughts. Maybe bad thoughts about ourselves and other people. And if you don't have that relationship with God, then what a loneliness that is. What a loneliness that is if you don't even have that relationship with God. You know? Not only you don't have people in your life, you don't even have Him. And if you have Him, you got them. You know, we have this thing where we're scared of people, we're scared of their judgment, we're scared of what we think about us, and what's even worse, if you're an alcoholic, the truth is, you probably have something realistically to be scared about. Because then there's the guilt. There's the how many people, you know, I mean, if I felt it, you felt it, have been walking along the street, how many people have thought about what's going to happen if I run into this person? Or run into that person. How many people have gotten a letter and they ripped it up and throw it away without even reading it? Or gotten a phone call or a message and not returned the phone call? You know, or the phone rings and says, I hope it's not him. I hope it's not her. How many people have seen somebody on the street and turned around and said, I hope he didn't see me. I hope she didn't see me. How many people are scared? How many people walk around with people on their mind? What am I going to do if he calls, if she calls, if they find out about this, if they find out? How many people are just sort of like trying to manage their lives, manage their existence to somehow, in some way, live their lives by avoiding other people? You know what I mean? Because they're worried because of something they did or didn't do, whatever it is. Families, God Almighty, people. How many people have a sponsor, haven't spoken to their father in 10 years, their mother in 20 years, their brother in 10 years? You know, I mean, there's all sorts of dysfunction and in isolation from people. You know, and many times it's because of stuff that we did. You know, all that stuff has to be cleared away. But you want to know something? And this is maybe just for me. I think it's biblical. I think it's from the book. Even if you do and of course the eighth step comes out of the fourth step. We see it all when we do the fourth step, and we write it down, we write down the eighth step. But you know something? Even if you do that stuff, in my opinion, based upon what I know and how it's worked for me, it still ain't going to work real well unless it has that secret ingredient. It's got to have the secret ingredient. All this stuff works with a secret ingredient. You know, the third step becomes before all these steps. It all has to work. The secret ingredient has to be involved in the entire mess, you know, in order for it to work. And what happens? What is the result of this deal? I mean, why do you do this? You know, it says after you do this, somewhere around steps 8 and 9, that's when the promises come in. It says we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And if you try to imagine what that new freedom and the new happiness is, you can't imagine it because it's brand new. It's a freedom of fear, and it gets better and better and better. It's a freedom of fear from people and economic insecurity. It's that freedom. It may not be perfect freedom, but for alcoholics living on this planet, it's as good as it gets, and it gets better and better. What if you live your entire life somehow either in the forefront of your mind or in the back of your mind, worried about people and what they think about you and how they feel about you and all this sort of stuff, okay? And half the time we worry about this and we don't even know we're thinking about it, you know? If you live your life that way, okay, what must it be like to be able to go for a day or two or five without people on your mind, without worrying about what people think about you, about worrying about what people are talking about you? You know, I had that strange alcoholic paranoia that I thought people were always talking about me behind my back, you know? I mean, it's amazing, you know, how it runs our lives. Think about how it runs an alcoholic's lives. How many people do you know ever said after they came out of treatment or came to AA this question? Listen to the question. What do I say if somebody asks me whether I want to drink? Have you ever asked the question? What do I say if somebody asks me whether I had the drink? Think about the implication of that question. You just find out you're an alcoholic. You found out if you're going to drink, you're going to die. You find out the worst thing that'll happen to you is you're going to drink. And this is and you know it's like poison to you. And you, the biggest thing on your mind is what your cover story is going to be. What another person is going to think. You need to have a cover story that sounds good to you, so you can make sure that no matter what you say, when they answer that question, the person will still like you and understand you and feel good about you. Because God forbid they judge you or they laugh about you, you would rather drink and destroy yourself and everything about your life than risk some guy's displeasure that doesn't even pay your Visa bill. And so if you find yourself with a group of people that you don't even know and they're drinking, you will drink with them because you would rather drink than risk the discomfort of people you don't even know not liking you. And if you're an alcoholic, that's exactly what you are right now, whether you think so or not. And if you don't understand that, then it's just one of these things that's your devastating weakness that you don't realize, and you'll never find true happiness. Because the first step of getting out of jail is you got to know you're in jail in the first place. So I just feel sorry for you if you don't understand that that's the truth. That's where that question comes from. It comes from worrying about what other people think about me. Otherwise, any normal person would say, you know, if somebody asked me, do you want a drink, he'd slap them, you know? I used to say to my sponsor things like, you ever get resentments? He says, get them, I give them. I was amazed. Because I used to go through life. Why doesn't he like me? What did I do? How can I make them like me? You know, what did I do? Why did I make them like me? Marlon Brando has this great line, if there's 300 people at the party and one doesn't like me, I got to leave. I think I told you guys this once. I was talking in Toronto once. There were like 3,000 people on a Sunday morning. I got through the whole thing. It was like an hour talk or something like that. And I see in the back of the room, all the way in the back of the room, big auditorium, I see right 30 seconds before I finish my talk, a guy walk out. And everybody else liked it and clapped it. And I don't even know why he walked out. You know, his wife might have given birth to twins. Maybe he shouldn't have been there in the first place. But the first thing that I said is, what did I say? They're driving me to the airport, telling me what a great talk it was, how they really appreciated it. All I'm thinking about is that guy. I had about, 10 years or 12 years, whatever the heck I had. But even then, it doesn't matter. I'm wondering about the guy. I'm not talking about the 3,000 that stayed. I'm wondering about the guy that left. Why did he leave, You know, that kind of thing. It just sticks with us. We just can't handle any form that even looks like rejection. Hey, let me tell you something. I remember sponsoring a guy, and I don't know where this comes from. It just comes from healthy thinking, who called me up, and he was complaining because he was really worried because there were some people at work that didn't like him. And I said, how many people work with you? And he says, 20 people. And he says, well, how many don't like you? He says, there's around 3 that don't like me. I says, well, let me ask you something. So that's like, what is that, like 12%? And says, how many people like you? Well, about 15, 20, and the rest don't care. I says, let me tell you something. If it ever gets more than 25%, if you don't have at least 25% of the people that don't like you, you're probably not saying anything. You know what I mean? In any group, there's always going to be somebody that can't stand you. you know, as a matter of fact, if you don't have somebody, hey, listen, you know, I do a lot of talking around. You understand what I'm saying? And, you know, if you're going to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, trust me on this, at any meetings or anything like that, you know, you're going to have 25% of people saying, I hate that Russell, he's so full of crap. You understand? If you can't handle that stuff, you might as well curl up and die. You might as well curl up and die. I mean, you're not saying anything. You know what I mean? If you're not if you're not going to talk about this program and this deal and what it means to you, you better be ready to be able to stand up like a man and say it the way it is and not be so worried about it. But you know, I know how that is to be an alcoholic. Do you want to chair the meeting? Oh, I'm not ready. That's what we say. Isn't that what we say? Oh, I'm not ready to chair the meeting. Well, what does that mean? That's alcohol code, isn't it? For I'm scared. We don't say I'm scared. I'm a scaredy cat. We say, Joe, why don't you chair the meeting? Oh, I'm scared. Why don't you do this? No, we say, I'm not ready. Oh, why don't you do that? Oh, I'm not ready. You know, why don't you sponsor us? I'm not ready. I'm scared. What will he think about me? What if I screw up? It's all about being scared. Where does that come from? Don't you want to get rid of that stuff? Can you imagine going through life? I mean, can you imagine being 40 years old and having that going on, 50 years old, 30 years old? Who needs that crap? And half the time, you don't even see how it's weighing you down and how it affects your life. It affects your love life. It affects your romantic life. It affects your relationship with other people. It even affects how you listen to people. Even in AA meetings, you know, when they're talking to you, it affects how you listen to your sponsor. It affects how you interact. You know, half the time, people can, the most incredible people can come into your life and tell you things that would rocket you into the fourth dimension, and you're not even listening to them because you're so damn scared of them. You're so scared of what they say because you're fearful. You're missing most of the stuff that's going on because there's stuff going on inside of you that's sort of like rejecting the deal. You know, so this stuff is like, these steps are, you know, incredible lifesavers, and this is part of it. This part of the eighth step is writing this stuff down. You know what I want to do? Don't you hate it when they say make a list, write it down, and stuff like that? Because what I want to do is I don't have to write this down. It's all up here. You know, in the sick part, you know what I mean? In the sick part, you know? No. You write it down. You write it down. It comes out of the fourth step. You know, and you know, you got that going with the sequel ingredient and you follow directions. That's why I think sponsorship is so important. You know, I'm going to end up by saying this. I absolutely believe that there is they say our alcoholic life, which I mean not just the drinking, because, you know, the drinking is the symptom. The real deal with alcoholism is centers in our mind. It's our thinking, not our body. You know what they say? Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. We drink because we can't stand being sober. Because sober is painful. That's why we have the four or five beers every night. That's why we do that, because we can't stand living with ourselves sober. And there's no getting away from our own brain and our own thinking except drinking or eating or doing something self-destructive. You know, that's the deal. That's why we do all this stuff. And that's why you have to understand, as I believe this stuff is so ingrained in us, and this is just the way we're built, that there's a strong gravitational pull towards the sickness. At any time in our life, there's always a strong gravitational pull on staying home rather than going to the meetings. There's a strong gravitational pull on being alone by yourself, isolating, you know, so you can think about how lonely you are. You know what I mean? And how you don't have any friends than going to the meeting, you know, and meet. There's a gravitational pull towards sickness, and we don't even realize it while we're doing it, okay? There's a gravitational attraction towards sick people, you know? You know, the guys we say, I hate my wife. She's such a bitch. We look for the guys who say, you're right. She is a bitch. My wife's a bitch too. You know what I mean? Instead of the guys saying, why don't you be grateful? There's a strong gravitational pull. And that's why it's mentorship, you know, like my sponsor, The Secret, is so important. I think probably one of the most important things, even more important than reading the book and the step meetings and everything, is my associating myself with certain men in my life, at least for the first 10 years I was sober, whether I did it intentionally, deliberately, or subliminally, put myself in a position where I listened to what they had to say, I respected them, and I did what they told me to do most of the time. I'm not saying I was perfect or anything like that, but I put myself under the tutelage of another person because they're the people who call you up on the phone and say things like, you need to go to a meeting. You know what I mean? And, of course, you want to say no, or you don't understand, or I don't, you know, and that's where the sickness is, you know, to be able to have that willingness to do that deal. They're the ones that are going to tell you, because you're going to want to say, you're going to want to read the eighth step and say, okay, I understand this. I know who I know the problem for, and you're not going to want to write it down. Because why write it down? You know what the problem is, and you're smart, and they're going to say, no, write it down, make a list, let me see it. They're the ones that are going to tell you to do the things you don't want to do, but you're going to do them anyway. And that's where that willingness comes in. So thank you very much. Next week we'll talk about step nine.
We're going to pass the basket. We forgot to pass the basket, Scott.